This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Kia ora. This is a special crossover episode of the Nelly's Baby podcast with the Black Sheep podcast. My name's William Ray, I'm the host of Black Sheep, and I also helped out Kirsty Johnston as a producer for the Nelly's Baby podcast. Now, after we finished making Nelly's Baby, Kirsty and I decided that we actually wanted to dig a little bit deeper into the history of institutions like Porirua Hospital, and seeing as Black Sheep is all about the darker side of New Zealand history, we decided to pull together a crossover episode where we tell the story of institutions in some more depth. So here is that special crossover episode. Hope you enjoy it. Kia ora, Kirsty.
Kia ora, William. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Now, hey, maybe it's best that you explain a little bit about what Nelly's Baby is about before we get underway.
Yeah, sure. So the podcast is about a woman called Sarah who was adopted, and she always knew she was adopted, but when she was in her mid-20s, found out that her birth mother had actually spent her whole life living in a psychiatric institution, which is the former lunatic asylum at Porirua. So the podcast is actually about Sarah some years later trying to put her mother's life story really back together. So we go looking for why she was institutionalized. We try and find her father, because Nellie obviously had Sarah while she was in Porirua. And then we also look into how she died, which was kind of mysterious, I guess. That's how we ended up at institutionalisation, really, wasn't it, William? Because we got fascinated by how Nellie was affected by her time at Porirua.
Yeah, and I think the reason we got hung up on this was, like, partly the horror of it, and we'll get back into that in a second, but also it's so recent. Like, it's totally within living memory. Like, you spoke to several people who had been institutionalised for huge chunks of their lives.
Yeah, if you think the asylums, well, the institutions were only shut down in the 90s, you know, that's real living memory. And Nellie only went into the institution in the 60s. So again, yeah, it's not like we're talking about the 1800s.
But we sort of wanted to know, like, where did these institutions come from? Like, well, who set them up? Why did they think it was a good idea? And, like, also how to think about them a bit, hey? Because one of the things you kept coming back on is, like, how do we judge these institutions? Like, is it right to judge them by modern standards and things like that, right?
Yeah, I really struggle with that because, yeah, it does seem like a different time. But, you know, it's post-World War II, it is modern, so I went back and forward, and that's how we ended up with this podcast, where we've brought in a friend of mine, Dr. Hilary Stace, to come and speak with us today.
And listeners to Black Sheep will remember Dr. Hilary Stace came on for our episode on eugenics. So, yeah, look, welcome Dr. Stace.
Oh, thank you. I'm Hilary, my name is.
No, Dr. Stace, apologies. So, I mean, where should we start with this?
I think it's always good to start in, you know, colonial New Zealand, when a lot of people, immigrants, particularly British immigrants, were coming to New Zealand for some kind of better society, an ideal society. They wanted to get away from the poverty, the asylums, those big asylums in Britain, the workhouses, and they thought, here, you know, come to New Zealand and everything will be nice. And so the idea that, yeah, this was an ideal society, but in an ideal society, it's not necessarily inclusive. So there is no room for people who, for example, are going to not be productive workers, or are going to require extra support.
So just to give a bit of a timeline for our listeners, the first law passed in New Zealand relating to institutionalisations is something
called the 1846 Lunatic Ordinance, and that basically says any person certified as a quote-unquote lunatic by two doctors and a magistrate could be locked up in a prison or in a hospital. And that was obviously a pretty horrific situation for these people. So in the 1860s and 70s, you see the rise of purpose-built facilities called lunatic asylums. But I guess what I found surprising is that when you look at the stuff being written about quote-unquote, you know, lunatics in this era, it's often quite sympathetic. Like we have a quote here from an 1864 report into lunatic asylums by a provincial council select committee. It says, lunatics should be regarded by the state as objects of tender solicitude, and no pains or expenses should be spared in ameliorating their condition. They, meaning the committee, wholly condemn their being treated as paupers or prisoners. So I guess the question is, how do we get from that sort of thing to the more, I guess, eugenic attitudes of the early 20th century?
Once we had the 1877 Education Act, the more we had testing, the more we had those sort of ways to judge people and their abilities, the more there was found that there were people who weren't meeting some ideal standards of what should be expected from people. And so as well as that, there was Darwin's theories of evolution were being turned into what's called social Darwinism, whereby there was a morality thing put on top of it. So if people had some impairments or any sign of things like alcoholism or something like that, it was considered that they it was some kind of defect. And it was also morally a moral risk to the rest of the population. And by the 1903, a very prominent Wellington doctor and politician put out a little booklet called The Fertility of the Unfit. And in that, he actually advocated for sterilisation of various groups of people who he saw as undesirable for this new society. Well, the society was developing, but he saw them as problematic groups.
I've just got this pamphlet in front of me, and it's several hundred pages long, actually. Yeah. It's quite detailed. Yeah. But right at the end, he gives us sort of like TLDR in sort of 12 points, which is, I'll just run through it. So what he says, the birth weight is rapidly and persistently declining. The food rate is persistently increasing. The declining fertility is not uniform through all classes. The fertility of the best is rapidly declining. The fertility of the worst is undisturbed. The policy of the state is inimical to the fertility of its best and fosters the fertility of its worst citizens. The infertility of the best stock is due to voluntary curtailment of the family through sexual self-restraint, which again is that morality thing you're talking about, because he says no such factor does or can obtain as a check to the fertility of the unfit. And basically goes on to say that, you know, all these different methods need to be tried, including what does he say there? Tubo ligature, which I'm presuming is sterilization of women.
It is. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so here we have a group of very privileged white people deciding what groups are should and shouldn't be allowed to actually breed. Those ideas develop and we get a eugenics education society with some quite wide influential membership. In about 1910, Truby King sets up Plunkett. He thinks people, you know, you can improve the quality of people by, you know, four-hour feeding or better nutrition or mainly educating mothers how to be better mothers. So there's all these ideas like that. But at the same time, and there's this whole worldwide idea of different values of different groups. And in New Zealand, this comes in a 1911 what is called the Mental Defectives Act, which sets out to label different types of defect. And they, you know, it's all merged. It's all mental health, physical, all those things sort of merge into one sort of idea of defect. But they do categorise them in various ways, like imbecile and idiot. And each of those, there's six categories, including epileptic. And each of those categories has a particular way those people should be controlled and surveilled by the state, because there is a risk that their unfitness, their defectiveness, will pollute these, you know, the better quality of people who, you know, as you just read out, they are the ones whose birth rate is theoretically declining. And there was also this assumption that the people who were had defects were, they were more fertile. So unless you constrained all these things, there would be more of these defective people sort of taking over.
And when we talk about fertility, we're not talking about, like, you know, infertility, IVF, the way we talk about today. We're talking about just people having more sex, basically.
Yeah, yes. And also, yeah, so all that morality around sex is also part of it. So I mean, there's a lot of sort of talk about promiscuous girls and defective men who are predatory. You know, it's all those assumptions going on in the background. So, yes, there's ideas of where you send these people. And so residential schools for those they think are educable and then other institutions are starting to grow for those that really just need to be locked away. So there's some sort of segregation going on in that. And then in the 1920s, there's two commissions of inquiry, and one is about sort of that venereal disease thing, which mainly blames these terrible women, very, very misogynist. But the chair of that then goes on to do the next one, which was really important, which is a commission, and it looks at mental defect and links defectiveness and morality. And that leads to the 1928 Mental Defectives Amendment Act, in which they really sought legal sterilisation of certain groups. The sterilisation doesn't get through, though it was happening in various other countries, such as the US. But Theodore Gray, who was a very influential head of the mental hospitals department at that time and wanted sterilisation, he didn't get his way with sterilisation, but he got to set up the first sort of farm colony, which was Templeton, the beginnings of Templeton, and that was started for boys, and he personally signed the first entry certificates for these boys who would go to Templeton, who would then theoretically be kept away. The idea of institutions was, firstly, you got them out of society so they stopped being a risk to, particularly for reproduction and taking over, these bad genes taking over the taking over the good white population. They would be totally contained for their lives. And Templeton didn't finally close until 2000. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff happened there. And the Royal Commission on Abuse and Care, which has been meeting since 2018, has a lot of stories about incredible abuse in Templeton. So Templeton, at the height, had hundreds of young people, and then they never left. So those that survived into, you know, adulthood. And that pattern was repeated around the country. There were little sort of units in some hospitals. There were the big institutions like Lake Alice, which was founded in 1950, but has terrible, terrible history. Didn't close till 1990s. Still so many stories of abuse and exclusion and horrible lives that so many people, you know.
So, Hilary, if I'm right, the difference between, like, the psychiatric hospitals and the psychopedic ones, that psychopedic was more oriented towards people with intellectual disability, is that right?
Well, psychopedic was for children, well, more for children, but there really weren't those distinctions early on. So, you know, the when Porirua was first started in the, you know, late 1900s, and it rapidly became a huge institution and a big, you know, a huge farm. So it could look after all its, you know, everybody worked as a farm. It didn't have to, it was just this big, huge industrial sort of complex, which happened to also have several hundred people. But some of them went in, some of them were disabled babies, say Down syndrome. Some of them were adults with, and men maybe with, you know, serious psychosis.
Sorry, people went in like literally as infants, would go in.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Wow. That's, and there was this, because of the fear of children and particularly sort of adults and children to reproduce, you know, children were quite a risk because they could grow up and then they could, because they'd, you know, obviously had some defect, they were obviously going to grow up and pollute the population. I mean, there were people fighting against the big institutions because, you know, if you didn't, if you had a disabled child, like a child with Downs, you didn't automatically want somebody to take it away and say, oh, it'll be for the best, go away and forget about it, and we'll take this child and you may never hear about it again. I mean, parents didn't want that. They wanted community support. They wanted schools. They wanted futures for their kids. I mean, I've got an adult son with autism, and I mean, I wouldn't want anybody to take him away. I mean,
and this is a really important point, right? Because I think, you know, like Kirsty was saying, there's a sort of, you worry about pushing our modern morality back into time, and, you know, people might not have known better. But as you point out, there are these groups like the Intellectually Disabled Children's Parents Association, which is the forerunner to modern IHC.
It was IHC. It just changed its name several times.
Oh, I see.
Yes, 1949, sorry, so the parents actually set up their core group and it expanded quite rapidly.
The point is, like, there are people making the same arguments we would make today in a lot of ways.
If you look at something like learning support and inclusive education, there's the same arguments. You know, we want all our children included, and we want everybody to participate in society and have equal rights.
And what's the response to that? Is it just,
well,
you know,
constantly,
oh, you know,
well, there are constant reviews, but there's also a big lobby of people who don't think it's worth wasting money on disabled children, you know, so put them, and that was one of the reasons about the institutions from the 70s on. It was expensive because there were the deinstitutionalisation processes were slowly happening, but the institutions were still there, so there was sort of double funding, and it was very difficult. You know, sometimes the government was often attacked for having to fund two systems, and you know, if now, I mean, if you talk. In fact, I was just reading somewhere just the other day, somebody was saying, oh, we should bring back, I know it was Trump saying, oh, we should, and they were talking about mental health in one of those debates, and he said, oh, we should bring back those big institutions. That was a good system, and people were kept safe. What he's saying is they were kept away, you know.
We heard an echo of that. Kirsty and I listened to this documentary, which was done interviewing these former nurses at Porirua. Mm. I think was it back in the 50s, Kirsty, or was it?
They started working there in the 30s or 40s, I think, and then they were in the 80s when they did the interview, which was kind of in the early 2000s. So they'd gone back to, there's a museum on the former Porirua site, and they'd gone back to have a look around and were talking about their experiences.
Look in, you wouldn't see a soul in here. And you'd have to come and feel all around in the straw, and they'd be as warm as toast, stark naked, because they wouldn't keep a canvas gown on. And I remember saying to somebody once, isn't it disgusting that these people are lying under straw? And this bloke, it was one of the doctors, what are you going on about? He said, a horse lies under straw and it's as warm as toast. And I thought, how right he is.
Again, when you talk about, you know, hierarchies, the medical hierarchy has been particularly strong and very, very hard to challenge. So other things, many staff members now say, look, I couldn't challenge, or I didn't know how to, or nobody would believe me. So it was very, very hard for, a nurse to challenge a doctor. And also the doctors almost always thought they were doing cutting-edge science. Every person, every administrator would come in and do something different. So when they had lobotomies, which were only used for a very few years, and there's statistics about how many were done in New Zealand, this was the latest fashion, you know, and there are a few particularly skilled surgeons who did it and trained, you know, so, and this is all going to be for the best.
We've got actually another clip which illustrates that, I think, perfectly, talking about electric shock therapy.
When we came to work, we were all very toey, because this was new altogether. And he was going to put some electrodes on, and the patient was going to go off and do a seizure, come out of it again, we hoped. You know. However, it all went well. The whole thing went well. And the patient, 2 days later, talked to us as if she'd been there all her life, quite sensibly. She went home in a week.
So as you heard there, ECT, electric shock therapy, genuinely it did cure some people, and it's still used today under anaesthetic as a treatment for things like catatonia, depression and bipolar disorder. But what these nurses obviously don't mention is what we know now, which is that ECT was also extensively used in ways which were completely inappropriate, and including as a punishment.
ECT was used as a punishment for a lot of people and unanaesthetised. But again, it was seen as a way to... Some people would probably think they were doing the best, you know, would calm them down and everything else. For others, it was to keep order. So if you've got a big institution with a busy ward and not many staff, anything, including psychotic drugs or ECT or any of those things, which would keep things calmer, were seen as really good. But if you talk to hear some of the testimony from, say, the Lake Alice, the boys who were in the adolescent unit in Lake Alice in the 1970s, you know, 50 years later, that trauma is and the damage is as fresh as if they just had it.
Yeah, because when we were looking into Nellie's story, she and some of the other people we talked to from Porirua were terrified of shock treatment. Like, in her later years, she went to court. Her sister had to go to court to get, like, a guardianship order for her, and Nellie thought that they were going to get permission to shock her again. And in the notes, you can see how frightened she is by that prospect. And then, you know, whenever we, I think what William and I struggled with was like the differing experiences, like you're saying, of staff and the doctors and the nurses versus the patients. Like, they are so far apart in their experiences that it made it really hard to pick through.
Pick through them. If you, if you have the whole ethos that there's a group that's dehumanised, you know, and if some, like the Kimberley kids, you know, and it's quite often hear stories from nurses that, you know, to wash them all, you know, they had group washing, group, you know, toileting, but you just put the fire hose on them, you know, all of the whole room full of people.
Because and they're not like us, right? That's
they're not the like us. Thing. And they're even different. Though the nurses, and some nurses didn't like doing that and they thought it was wrong because they were told to do it, but also they're not like us. This is the way they're different. They're lesser humans. And when you ever get to a situation where somebody can say, these are lesser humans, that justifies us all sorts of terrible things. And so that, you know, if you anybody ever hints that there are different groups of humans with different value, that's, I think, is a red flag, and you can see it in all sorts of contexts, even now.
And just in case people think we're exaggerating here, like, Kirsty, you came across a quote, I think it was from a doctor, who was sort of saying, pointing to like a gash that a patient had got, and was sort of going, well, look, for you and me, that would hurt a lot, but for one of these, you know, insane people, they barely feel that.
Yeah, they don't hurt like us.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what we don't also, we haven't mentioned again, is that there are disproportionate numbers of Māori were being institutionalised from children and adults. And there also was that theory, well, they're brown people, so they don't feel pain, which is very, very common. They're lesser, you know, intellectually lesser than us white people. So there are all those assumptions still, if not overt, still simmering right throughout the century and probably still now.
So, Hilary, you've obviously been paying quite a lot of attention as well to the Royal Commission, like the evidence that's been heard there. And I've read through a lot of it as well. And what do you think so far it tells us about the experiences of people in these institutions? I mean, I've got a Janet Frame quote here. So Janet Frame was an author and she was in Seacliff, I think, in Dunedin. And she said there was a personal, geographical, even linguistic exclusiveness in this community of the insane, who yet had no legal or personal external identity, no clothes of their own to wear, no handbags, no purses, no possessions, but a temporary bed to sleep in with a locker beside it and a room to sit in and stare, called a day room. Many patients confined in other wards of Seacliff had no name, only a nickname, no past, no future, only an imprisoned now.
That would apply to so many institutions. And Sir Robert Martin has a very, he experienced Kimberley, abusive foster care, Campbell Park, various other places. And his is the same. His, you know, there were no markers of identity really. But what he had and what Janet Frame had were words to talk about it. Most people didn't have words or an opportunity of any way of communicating any of this. And so now we have survivors of places like Templeton who are, you know, elderly men mainly living in residential care who still can't tell their story to the Royal Commission because they don't have the spoken words, they don't have the ways to engage. And also, if you've been in a place since you were three and you're now 65, you're not going to know that what happened to you was a bad thing. I mean, it's just normal. Robert Martin talks about he had no understanding. He hadn't heard of the All Blacks, you know. Yeah. So all the 60s music, you know, so they were just deprived of so much and seen as so much, you know, as more animals, really.
Yeah, I think contained. What shocked me about that Janet Frame quote and what we found with Nellie's story wasn't the overt abuse. It wasn't like beatings or shock treatment. It was kind of this the mundane quality to their lives. Like, they had nothing. They had no identity. They had no activities to do. A few of them had jobs, possibly, but it just seemed like they were left to kind of just rot in these places. And I think that's what I found most confronting. And do you think that was kind of a universal experience?
Yeah, I think some of those bigger places like Porirua, you know, they were working farms. So some people did have those sort of jobs on the farm. I mean, you know, no payment or anything, but, you know, they did have roles. But most of the time, for most of the last century, the idea was just containment. You know, there wasn't anything therapeutic. It was all about containment and segregation. And it didn't matter that there was nothing to do because they weren't, you know, they weren't expected to live long, and most of them didn't. And then, of course, the families was, because they didn't live with families, if occasionally they did go home for a visit, people were scared of them, you know, because they didn't know, you know, how to behave in society. They didn't know. They had this big label, you know, defective or mad or something.
There is a real fear of the insane, isn't
yes.
there? I mean,
yeah.
I'm using the term the insane extremely yeah. broadly yeah. there, but like the way people would have understood and still do the insanity.
Yeah, they're scarily different. And I think there's still, we still haven't quite got that that understanding.
And what's your take, Hilary? Because, William, do we have that quote somewhere about institutionalisation and how it kind of spirals, like how going into these institutions, if you're young in particular, and being exposed to behaviour kind of worsens things? Do we have,
oh, yeah.
do we have that one?
Yeah, so this is a quote you got from talking to Richard Medlicott, who was actually Nellie's GP.
Yeah, that's right.
And was the GP at Elizabeth Memorial, which is a psychogeriatric hospital where a lot of people in institutions ended up after the institutions were closed.
In the bad old days, I mean, people were often kind of admitted to these long-term mental health hospitals for fairly innocuous stuff. And so people would go in and be surrounded by people who would have some severely abnormal behaviours, and they would learn abnormal behaviours. So that's the issue with institutionalisation, is it's not just the illness, it's that you're surrounded by, instead of being surrounded by young adults or children whose behaviour we would class as more normal, to put that in parenthesis, you know, you're surrounded by people who are doing odd behaviours.
One of the things that is quite shocking when you first hear about it is the Kimberley cringe. It's when somebody comes near somebody who's spent a long time in an institution and they immediately sort of cover up their head and go into that fetal position expecting to be hit. That idea that if somebody came close, it wasn't because they were going to give you affection or food or something, it's because you were going to get punished in some way. They were not just occasional. It's quite a well-known phenomenon. That's... I mean, you know, we're just talking all the bad stuff in institutions. Some people would say that, you know, it wasn't too bad and there were good staff and some people got a little bit of education and then some people actually got out and went and lived in, you know, sort of some sort of basic employment. But we are talking here about hundreds of people who went through institutions.
And then you have, as you say, some of the staff, the sort of response that they have to sort of like, but what would you do differently? And actually we have a quote from the nurses.
The patient had to be safe, had to be secure, had to be warm, wouldn't keep clothes on. There was nothing else really that you could do. There were pipes up there that the heat, but sometimes the heat wasn't enough. Sometimes it was too much, you couldn't breathe. But at least they were safe. And so was everybody else.
How do you respond to that, Hilary?
You know, the idea about safety is always used to justify some extreme restraint or seclusion. But actually, it's not a long-term solution. It only causes more trauma, whereas there are other ways. And it's complicated, but it can be done. And there are dozens of New Zealand young people and adults with high needs living in the community with well-trained carers now. I mean, that's another issue. It's problematic, and the workforce is maybe not as many people available to do that sort of work, but it can be done.
I mean, could it have been done back then? Because these nurses are talking about the sort of when they were working there in the 30s and 40s and 50s, which is before the invention of modern antipsychotic drugs and before a lot of understanding about how talk therapy can help. Was there another option even back then?
The idea of rights for individual, particularly individual groups, didn't really start until the 60s, and that was international, you know, racism, feminism, all that, and disability rights came with that. So if you talk about rights, you're talking a different conversation about defect and difference. In those days, you didn't talk about rights. And also, you know, there was a lot more fear. People had fewer options and less understanding of human development. I mean, they're all relatively recent. Like social work, really only the idea of social work only started in the 50s. The idea that children with autism could be educated was really new in the 1960s. These are all relatively recent concepts which are constantly evolving. When you put into it the people who were employed in some of these places, who were often a person who has just been discharged from the army with PTSD, you know, it's not a good mix. And I think that's where some of the problems arose. There wasn't the training, there wasn't the understanding. The First and Second World War, but the Second World War particularly, cast a long shadow over the 50s and 60s and all that, I think, you know, that whole fear. There were these other groups who were, we didn't know how to deal with them, you know, like juvenile delinquents. That's why we set up the Epurney Boys Home, to deal with those delinquents in Nainai, you know. You know, I would say there's a lot of good intentions and a lot of people who are in the system, and there's often stories about, you know, there was one particular staff member who did take us out and we did do this, and if they were on, you know, we knew we'd be well looked after. But it was that once you get an institution, bullying of any kind is almost impossible to avoid.
And actually, one point Dr. Olive Webb made at the Royal Commission, which really stuck with me, actually we've got this clip.
Hand on heart, I have not seen an individual staff person being cruel, but the systems in which everybody lived and worked were terribly cruel, because you had one group of people who had the power of life and death and daily activity and every single piece of power that you could wish to have, completely dominating another group who had absolutely no power at all. They didn't decide what they ate, what they wore, where they went, or anything. They were required to be obedient.
And Dr. Webb, we should say, worked at some of these institutions and played quite a big role in the deinstitutionalisation movement.
The last institution to close, the big one, was Kimberley. It didn't close till 2006. And there was huge opposition from the parents and family members group because, again, they thought they were safe there. And it took a march on Parliament led by Robert Martin, who had this lived experience of it, and he led a march to Parliament. And finally that was closed. But Ruth Dyson is particularly, she was the minister at the time, but she had to, it was a very careful job because there was this fear. And there was also there were some not very good stories of the deinstitutionalisation process from the 70s. To get that, the good new accommodation and the new houses and get up the proper care and support and get the acceptance from their new communities, all those things were slow and, quite tricky to do. And sometimes it was the parents who opposed them the most. So, you know, I don't think many of them would still oppose the closure of the institutions, but it was hard for everybody. And that whole idea of, you know, safety was very, you know, important to many, and they were safe somewhere, locked up.
Yeah, we heard a bit of that in Nellie's story, didn't we, William, about how when Porirua was closed, which kind of happened over quite a long time frame, it's not like, you know, I think sometimes you think of it and you think they've just opened one day and shut the next. It was probably like 20 years. But when Nellie finally had to leave, you know, somebody, I think it was a social worker, suggested a placement for her, and it wasn't until a nurse intervened and said, no, she needs 24-hour care, that they were able to find her somewhere suitable, because otherwise she might have just ended up in like a halfway house, you know, and that really wouldn't have been safe in her case.
No, I think that was quite a common story too, that the deinstitutionalised process was probably not as carefully done as it should have been done.
And because it came at the same time as like other competing priorities, right? Like there was fiscal savings.
This is the same time as like the, you know, oil shocks, and then you have the fourth Labor government coming in, like.
And that, yeah, but also there was the neoliberalism of the 90s. A lot of organisations either lost their funding or had a very hard time competing for funding. Disability support went from social welfare to health with very tight eligibility requirements. So there were a whole lot of other things happening that made that, particularly the 90s, I think, a particularly hard time.
One thing I wanted to ask about is the sort of continuing fear of institutions, because I don't want to breach privacy here, so I've got to be tricky how I word this, but I know of someone who has never been institutionalized, has never been diagnosed with any kind of disability of any kind, but clearly has some psychological problems. And I think a big part of why that's never happened is because they are terrified of ending up in an institution. That struck me as just one of the really insidious, long-lasting implications of institutionalisation.
Yeah, that idea that of asylum is actually a really valid idea. There are times when people need asylum. You know, they need a peaceful space where they can, you know, get well or something, you know, have a little space away from the difficult world. But we've lost that whole idea of asylum, of quiet, I mean, you know, that quiet place where people have time and nurturing to get over whatever it is, the crisis in their life.
It's funny because it actually sounds more like the sort of 19th century ideas of like health spas, I know, were really popular for a while.
But like going to the seaside for your consumption.
Yeah.
Is that almost what we need to go back to? These sort of like boarding house type things, sort of where people just sort of check themselves in for a temporary period.
Well, for some people, it depends on what their individual circumstances is, but that might be something. And I think that has been suggested and even trialled in some small, by some mental health NGOs. But, you know, they're houses, they're community houses with caring people who will just take care of you, of people who are in some kind of distress. I mean, it's all possible. It's just the funding and the attitudes. I mean, it really, if, you know, listen to the people who have the lived experience of institutions, and you get ideas of what could be better. So the people like Robert Martin are very valuable. And in the Royal Commission, you know, we're hearing there's so many similar themes, you know, that lack of power, the being seen as the problem, The individualization of your problem, you know, the idea of defect, the idea that you're a less valuable human, and that other people have power and control over you, they're such common themes that, you know, we should be able to do something about addressing those without having that whole idea of institutions, having nice, peaceful places.
Kirsty, is there anything else you want to ask just in our last couple of minutes here?
No, I think we've done really well. Thank you, Hilary. You're, as always, the font of all knowledge.
Well, I don't know. I haven't got lived experience. I'm only an observer and a learner.
We really appreciate your time.
We really do. And thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for coming in. And thank you, Kirsty, for bringing me along on the Nellie's Baby story. I'll push again that our listeners should absolutely go and listen to that series. It is just really eye-opening.
So has it come out yet? Is it already out?
No, but by the time this releases, it'll be out. Right now, I'm going to literally get off this call and then go back to editing the final episode.
Oh, I thought I'd missed it.
Yeah, you're breaking our continuity here, Hilary.
Sorry.
This special crossover episode of Black Sheep and Nellie's Baby was produced and presented by Kirsty Johnston and William Ray. The executive producer is Tim Watkin and the executive editor is John Hartevelt. The production coordinator is Brianna Juretich and the sound engineer is Phil Benge. If you want to hear more RNZ podcasts, you can follow or subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube or wherever else you find podcasts. And you can also listen ad-free at the series and podcast page at rnz.co.nz. Ka kite anō.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.